This episode is brought to you by Rancho Gordo, growing the best and most interesting heirloom beans available. Learn more at ranchogordo.com.
This week on Meet and Three, it's all about screens. We're diving into the world of TV, computers, and even VR to figure out how food consumption is shifted by a digital lens.
Every course talks about a different topic within the Asian American identity through a very personal lens. And the three courses that are paired with VR, in it, you're seeing a brushstroke by brushstroke recreation of the dish that you're about to eat.
Most of us in the world live in urban areas. And so how much is the city already accidentally providing its residents? And how much more could it provide if we just made it a priority?
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Gentlemen.
Hey.
What's going on?
Oh, man. Well, we're still in the midst of the pandemic, and I am moving. Not necessarily by choice.
Well, yeah, you've talked about moving on the show so much, and, you know, everyone in the world listens to the show, so surely your landlord found out.
Secret's out, man.
And was mad at you for not giving your notice. Yeah.
Yeah, being evicted and sued for back rent and all that good stuff. But, you know, I feel... I'm not alone. I feel that, you know, the threat that he keeps pointing at me is you'll have an eviction on your record. And I'm like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, especially here in the city, are going to have that same thing. It's not really going to be a factor anymore.
Exactly.
Like Greg, I think Greg said off air, like, if everybody's fucked, then nobody's fucked.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the great equalizer, man.
Yeah, levels the field. However, you know, I'm going to Damon Bolte this situation and be a brightsider and say the apartment that we're hopefully moving into is easily 10 times better than the apartment I live in right now. It is literally 3 times the size, plus it has an equally sized private backyard.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole situation may be somehow strangely for the better. So, you know, though it's uncomfortable and the timing isn't good, I'm not, you know, super excited to you know, have movers and all that sort of situation going on during COVID. But, you know, we'll get it packed up as tightly as we can and everybody will wear masks and I guess we'll get out of Dodge.
Yeah, man. So you're saying there's room for a hot tub, huh?
There actually is, Damon. We can hot tub this situation right up. And believe it or not, strangely that you would bring that up, a friend of mine and yours, I think you know Carter, he's moving out of his place because his building got sold, so he has to move out. But he has one of those semi-permanent, semi-portable hot tubs, and the place he's moving into has no place for it. So there might be a deal struck here.
There you go.
So what you're saying is, like, yes, the next 3 months of the Speakeasy are just going to have, like, a low bubbling sound underneath of it as we're recording.
I mean, you know, if all goes well, Greg, that's the idea. Damon, fill us in on the fires and the situation there on the West Coast.
Oh, my God. I'm like the weatherman now. So, like,
yeah. Yeah, so weather last on the ones week with Damon Bolte.
Exactly. So last week, the sky was deep, dark, burnt orange, literally burnt orange. Yes. And you couldn't see the sun. You barely see it. Today it's blue and you can see the sun enough to where when you stare at it, it burns your eyes. So it's doing what it's supposed to be doing.
All right, well, so that's an improvement.
After a week of staring at it, trying to find it, now it's back to whatever normal is, I guess. But yeah, it sounds like all the smoke has since not dissipated, but moved over to the East Coast. And so you're enjoying some of what we had last week.
Yeah, well, I went for a bike ride on the west side yesterday, and I was watching the sunset over the Palisades. And, you know, I mean, none of the East Coasters on this podcast are the people that you want to ask about whether or not the sky looks a certain reddish color.
Yeah.
We will not be able to tell you with any accuracy. But, you know, I do remember kind of watching the sunset, and I didn't think, wow, that's red, because that's not a thought I've ever had. What I did think was, wow, that looks like Star Wars. And I thought it was just weird clouds or smog or something, but it was just a very extra menacing hue. And now today it's still kind of here, and I'm talking to you, put it together. I was like, oh yeah, it's what was happening over there. It's over here now.
Yeah, unbelievable that there's so much volume of smoke emanating from the West Coast that it's making it hazy here in New York City and the whole Eastern Seaboard. So it's really nerve wracking for us to be thinking about you over there. And I want to make sure you're safe and staying healthy.
Thanks, man. Yeah, the whole West Coast is on fire right now, but we're remaining safe and as positive as possible. Hopefully it gets taken care of soon. But yeah, it's pretty crazy, man. I'm mostly worried about the fact that the air quality is. You expect California to be the place where you do all your outdoor activities and get a little healthier, and then it's like, we can't go outside anymore.
Right. Suddenly the healthy outdoors are a menacing, unhealthy place to be.
Yeah. Even with a mask, but yeah, that's where we're at. How about you, Greg? What's going on?
I've been doing pretty much more of the same. I finally got sprung from Cuomo teen earlier this week, which is why I've just been like tearing around town. I was saying this early on in quarantine, but like, I feel like without a large number of places where I can just kind of go and walk to and be like, oh, I feel like going to here or there, I've been starting to feel like one of those extra large dogs that has to be walked like three times a day or they're going to tear up your furniture. So being stuck in my apartment for a couple weeks wasn't fun. It was necessary, but it wasn't fun. So I've just been rolling all over town. It did give me a chance to work on a new project that I've taken on. I've been a little coy about it here on the show, but at some point this summer, I looked at my life and I was like, producing two podcasts about drinking just isn't enough. So I took on a really awesome third project, which launched yesterday. It's a new podcast called The Right to Drink. And we are super fortunate enough to have the host of that podcast in the studio with us today. So please welcome Jarrett Dieterle of the R Street Institute. He runs drinksreform.org. And as of yesterday, he is the author of Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink, and the host of The Right to Drink, the new podcast. Welcome, man. Good to have you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here. A long-time listener, so it's fun to chat with you all.
Thanks, man. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
There you go.
You and I have been working on this thing for a couple months now? I don't know. What is the point of trying to figure out how long things have been going on anymore?
Yeah, time is meaningless.
Time.
Yeah.
It probably would have helped all of our sanity if it would have been a couple months. I think it was more like one in a week or so. Yeah.
I was thinking on it. I was like, yeah, well, we about halfway into this eternity we're all living through, we started working on this. I guess the first one launched yesterday. So did you do anything to celebrate that and the release of your book?
Yeah, yesterday was it was weird. So it kind of had this date circled on my calendar where, for a while I've known that that my book, cocktail book, was coming out on the 15th, and then in the last couple months, as you said, we got this podcast going on, and it was weird. It was kind of like this big momentous day, and kind of wait for it to arrive. My wife actually is my book agent, so she warned me this would happen, but it's a little anticlimactic when it finally gets to the day. You like expect like some explosion to go off or something somewhere, and like this to be like dramatic confetti like sprayed everywhere. It was good. I had a bunch of people reach out about it, had a little launch event for the book, and got to go out, do a little outdoor dining at one of our spots here in Richmond that's able to open at reduced capacity with my wife. And so that was fun to be able to do that, but also weirdly anticlimactic, just because I think I've had this dang date circled for so long in my calendar, and I don't know, I expected fireworks or something, but it was still good.
You didn't shake up a bunch of champagne and spray it all around your house like it's like the...
Formula One race car winner. Yeah.
No. I mean, well, so the bottle we opened was actually a not champagne. It was a Foggy Ridge cider from Diane Flint. It was her actually last kind of batch of cider before she hung up the cleat, so to speak, and got out of cider and went back into apple grow. And so it was this really like awesome bottle of hard cider, and we've been saving it for this. So I wasn't going to shake that up because I don't want to waste any of it.
Talk a little bit about how
I just want to throw in there, full disclosure, I blast off a bottle of champagne every day, every time we do the Speakeasy radio show. So they're all victories every week. But you know, I was wondering about like the so you were saying that Virginia's open at a limited capacity. So that's indoors, right? Because like we talked with someone about 2 months ago that was saying that it's pretty much Virginia's pretty wide open, right? As far as like the dining outside thing goes, correct?
Yeah. Compared to some states, that's definitely true. We outdoors been for a while, and then there's reduced capacity indoor here in Virginia as well, okay. Right?
Gotcha.
Yeah, we're about to move into that phase here in New York, and I'm still pretty nervous about it, frankly. I think we can talk about that as we go. But
yeah.
Jared, I want to hear a little bit more about your book launch. You know, I've had a couple of those, and they are strangely anticlimactic normally. How did it go to have your launch event be via Zoom because you couldn't do something in person due to the pandemic?
Yeah, I think that was probably part of what contributed to the a little bit anticlimactic, just because I kind of had this vision of, you know, family, friends, you know, connections being at some kind of a event together, kind of celebrating in person, and since it's a book about drinks, being able to have some drinks ideally.
Right.
So yeah, the virtual event was fine. I had a couple of more elderly you know, friends and family that had a little bit of trouble getting onto the actual login thing, which I think is par for the course right now with virtual events. But you know, it was recorded and it was fun. We made the best of it. That's why we ended up having Christine Riggleman, one of my friends that works, actually owns a distillery, is a master distiller in Virginia, and having her aboard was fun because she was able to talk a little bit about what her distillery has been doing with everything going on. So we made it fun. The audience was engaged, asking questions. So we encouraged people to bring along a cocktail. And so, yeah, it was different. There's no question about it. I'm not going to sit here and say that it was the same exact thing as having a live event somewhere. But we made the best of it, I guess. And that's kind of what's necessary to do. And in the grand scheme of life, you know, if the biggest problem that I have this year is that my book launch was virtual, then I'm doing pretty well.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, we're all doing the best we can with what we have. So you are a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, which is a think tank where you study alcohol policy. And that's kind of what your book is about. Talk about you and what that means and what that is. Like, what's kind of your grind every day?
Yeah. Well, I initially got into it from the policy angle of it. I wanted to research and write and think about public policy and how to improve it. And I also liked drinks and started, you know, learning more and more about cocktails and reading about it and beer as well, and realized I could combine these two things and, in my opinion, have, you know, maybe the coolest job in America, at least for a policy job. So alcohol is a really unique area of the legal system to study, as you guys well know, living it. It is full of quirky, bizarre, goofy laws that sometimes make sense and a lot of times don't make sense.
Right, and that's because post-prohibition, the federal government decided to allow every state to make its own laws, right?
Yeah, no, that's 100% it.
So we come up with this fucking scrambled egg mess that you can't, you know, you can't unscramble an egg. That's the problem.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah, now everyone kind of goes down to the bar, right? I'm sure at least I've done this before. You know, December 5, you know, repeal day, you know, celebrate back when we all could go to the bar, and you know, celebrate that. But what people don't realize is like none of like the temperance forces like just went away. You know, on December 5th, 1933, they still existed and just started lobbying state governments and local governments. And as you said, it ended up with this hodgepodge, you know, stew of 50 different laws and jurisdictions. And then all the local county guys have a lot of power too. So it's even more than that. It's thousands, really. And it just makes things incredibly difficult. So it's an area that's easy to study and try to talk about how it could be made more straightforward for producers mostly, but also for consumers at the end of the day, because, you know, we're all trying to get the product of A to the hands of the consumer at point B, and it's not as straightforward as it should be for the alcohol marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, you would think it would be kind of, you know, it's one of those things you look at and you're like, this should be simple. One person makes it, another person wants to buy it. How much more complicated could it be? But I mean, it's really once you start peeling back the layers of it that it gets, you know, I don't know. I have this weird, and let me know if you share this, because obviously, you know, your career is to look at all of these weird alcohol laws and write about them. And I feel like you can, most of the time when you're doing that, the thesis is like, why is this this way? Why have we done this this way? And why has it not changed? Because it very obviously makes no sense on its face. And sometimes when I look for these things, I almost feel like I'm exploring some sort of like undiscovered island. And like, you know, I come around the corner and there's this weird tree that's growing this absurd law that makes no sense that I've never seen before. And a part of me is like taken aback by it. And, you know, obviously I look at it and I'm like, well, that shouldn't be. But there's also a part of me that's like, how did this get here? How did we come about this? And it's an almost perverse appreciation of it. Like, does that sort of happen to you when you're doing your job?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's kind of a, it's a weirdly, beautiful mess. I mean, it's really terrible that it's like what it is, but it really, it's entertaining, I guess. You know, when you see things like Indiana, which, you know, allows gas stations to sell beer, but it can't be put in a refrigerator, it has to be warm beer. And you're just like, man, like how, like if I sat down for 100 years in a room and did nothing about, but thinking about retailing alcohol laws for Indiana, like I would not have come up with that distinction. And it just, you know, or in Utah with the infamous Zion curtain there and bartenders having to mix drinks behind a barrier. It's like, you know, I just never would have thought of that. Like if you, I think no one would have really. And so it definitely has a, almost like a trivia element.
Did.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I mean, and a lot of times it was people in 1930s that thought of it. So,
I mean, that's what I'm thinking, right? You said the Zion curtain, I can see that. That's anytime. That's not a piece of technology, but like, your beer can't be refrigerated. Was refrigeration a thing?
Right. You
know? Like right. common enough that they could say like, well, don't put it in the fridge.
That's exactly right. Yeah. What happens, obviously, you're right. So no, there's no refrigeration back in the day, and then refrigeration becomes a thing, and then they'll kind of reform it. So like, you know, certain licensees and liquor stores in a state like Indiana, they can refrigerate it, but, you know, gas stations can't. And then eventually they'll change it a little bit again, and they can refrigerate wine, white wine now, but not beer. And so it's just like it's trying to update the stuff for, you know, modern life and technology and morals in some cases with labels on bottles and what you can say and not say about a product. So yeah, it's exactly that. It's just like trying to update this, and it's always done in a piecemeal fashion that then when you look at how the sausage, you know, is made at the end of the assembly line, it just looks totally squirrely.
Yeah, it's funny because like I'm from Oklahoma, and I would go to the liquor store to get like your higher ABV beers, right?
Yeah,
you couldn't. Everything else is 3.2, you know, you in that, yes, you could buy cold in a gas station where you're getting gas to drive, right? But if I wanted to get a higher ABV beer in a liquor store, like say I just wanted like a Guinness or whatever it might be, Newcastle, whatever, and it's unrefrigerated because maybe they don't want you drinking it immediately, but at the same purchase that I'm making a bottle of mezcal, which I don't refrigerate, and I can drink that straight from the bottle. So it's like, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, no, the weak beer laws, the 3.2ers are a great example. I think there's only one left now. It's Minnesota, but it's funny. It's an example of them trying to update stuff for reality, right? I mean, we have these Imperial IPAs that are, you know, just, you know, high ABV hop bombs, and, you know, you can't sell those in some states at certain stores. And so they've made this big hullabaloo about going and updating that. And then, like, they're raising it to, like, you know, from 3.2 to 4.5. And it's just like, okay, like, it's still a massive part of the beer market that's getting locked out there, the way that beer is changing. And so, yeah, everything's just a fight. Everything's like a struggle to update this area of the law that's been so ossified for almost going on a century now.
Well, and also, I mean, part of it seems to me, the thing that, always perplexes and amuses me is the fact that, you know, these laws are written by people that very, you know, they are, to give them as much credit as I feel like giving them in this particular moment, they are trying to keep people safe. And that is a thing that, you know, we pay our lawmakers to do. But they very clearly don't have a lot of experience with, you know, definitely not making this stuff. And sometimes, you know, it seems like you look at these laws, like, have any of these people ever actually, like, drank a beer? Like, are they totally alien to this experience? It makes me think of now, you know, when I go to the bar and if I, you know, want to grab a table outside and a beer, the bartender has to serve me half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And every time it just sits there on the table and I look at it and I think to myself, yes, that is the thin line between responsible drinking and anarchy.
Yeah.
Right there. Peanut butter and jelly and Wonder Bread. Thank God it's there.
Yeah, that's keeping us from the chaos. Seems a good point to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'd love to dig a little bit deeper in on what you think maybe policies that might change due to COVID that might remain permanent. We've already seen some changes that we think are just here to be a Band-Aid, but maybe they'll become permanent. And then definitely we want to talk more about your book and what you do. So stay tuned to the Speakeasy, everybody. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Rancho Gordo. Over the past 19 years, Rancho Gordo has led the revival of heirloom beans, taking the lowly bean from a healthy but neglected member of the vegetable family to a near superstar status ingredient. From growing the best and most interesting beans available to making sure all crops are fresh and a pleasure to cook with, Rancho Gordo's mission is to encourage cooks to experience and enjoy the unique flavors of heirloom beans. Rancho Gordo produces nearly 30 varieties of heirloom beans and lentils, as well as corn, grains, chilies, and other cooking ingredients. You can learn more at ranchogordo.com. That's RANCHOGORDO.com.
And we're back. You were listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. We are talking with Jarrett Dieterle, who is the editor-in-chief of drinksreform.org. Do I have that right?
Yeah, any kind of editor title. It's a one-man site, so it's not get too excited here, yeah.
Editor-in-chief, chief writer, coffee boy, all of that.
Right,
yeah,
yep. Also the author of a new book, Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink, and a new podcast, The Right to Drink. And before the break, we were talking about how weird alcohol laws had been in this country from the repeal of Prohibition on December 5th, 1933, all the way up to, let's say, mid-March of 2020. And now it seems like everything is sort of in flux. Some states are going one way and getting way more permissive. Some states are going the other way and getting way more restrictive. And we want to talk a little bit about what that looks like from the policy side and whether or not you think some of these changes and updates that we're seeing might actually become permanent down the line.
Yeah, it's a $1 million question is what becomes permanentized here. But yeah, it's weird. There's this, as we've said, this area of the law that hasn't changed much, and all of a sudden COVID happens, and it was like this like great bonfire of the regulations almost, where everything was just like changing so fast. My life for a couple of weeks was crazy just trying to keep up on all of it, and it's still hard, frankly. But yeah, the thing that of course we've all seen is the to-go cocktails, alcohol, and delivery is just taken off. And I think it's 35 or something, 33, 35 states have some version of to-go alcohol now that didn't before. And almost all of them are doing it, you know, temporarily, but there's already been a couple states, Iowa, the first in the nation to go alcohol or to go cocktail.
Yeah, Iowa would lead that pack.
I know. That's what's wild about alcohol. Like, it has nothing to do with, like, you know, red state, blue state, or like any of that kind of stuff. It's just places that either are way behind the times or like are tremendously, you know, forward thinking on it. It just totally surprises you more times than it doesn't. But yeah, it's been the big change, and it's going to be, I think that there was going to already be this change just because everyone's used to getting things delivered to their door already pretty much in the economy. And in some places, at least, it's harder to do that with alcohol. In some states, you can't really. And so then COVID happens and all of a sudden it's happening. And I feel like it's going to be really hard to put that toothpaste back in the tube. I just feel like consumers are going to, once they get that, are going to say, hey, you know, it's pretty convenient. Like, I don't have to hop in the car after I've had a couple drinks at the barbecue to get another, 24 pack of beer. I can just get that delivered to me, or I can have another round of margaritas dropped off. So,
well, not to mention, I feel like the general consumer in America who travels from state to state is just confused already. So to now have this kind of open up and then try and repeal and shut some of it back down, I think the consumer would just be tearing their hair out.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Yeah, people, I think, will more and more want some consistency because it's so darn inconsistent. And, you know, obviously it'll be interesting. I don't think you guys would know better than I would. I don't think every restaurant in the world or bar of the world is going to want maybe to do a to-go format. But I think the option will be there probably in more states when all this is said and done.
Yeah. I think, like back in April, we heard that Michigan was going to allow some dog barking outside my window right now. Sorry about that.
Is that Banjo the dog?
No, it's some other dog. So back in April, Michigan announced that they were going to allow to-go cocktails until 2025. I mean,
right.
That seems like a long stretch of time to say we're going to do this for 5 years and then take it away. I mean, are we to predict that that's just something they're going to try for a while and then eventually they're going to be like, yeah, well, this works, so let's continue doing this?
Yeah, I don't know. I've seen a couple states that have done these like extensions to 2023, 2025. I actually submitted some a written testimony for the Michigan one you referenced, and I it just didn't make any sense to me. I was like, just make this permanent. Why are you, what's like 5 years going to do? I mean, I could understand almost like an experiment for like 6 months or something to see if this works, but like a 5-year experiment, and then all of a sudden you're going to tell all the residents of Michigan that this thing they've been doing for 5 years, they're not able to do anymore. So I feel like it'll just create more legislative busy work. Every 5 years they'll have to think about that again. So yeah, I think that it's a heavy down payment, I guess, towards it permanency. I just think that maybe they don't want to make the lawmakers, as we well know, don't particularly like being ambitious and leaders sometimes. So it's maybe a way to take a timid step forward, but start paving the road towards permanency. Yeah, but I think more we're gonna go permanent eventually when this is done.
I mean, to play devil's advocate here, I would think that if I were, say, a retailer, a liquor store owner, or even that gas station that has beer, that I would be upset to know that people could just have stuff delivered from restaurants. Like, I foresee to-go cocktails remaining, maybe not just to, like, currently, as the law is opened up here in New York City, as a bar, I can now sell you a bottle of mezcal that Damon loves, mm-hmm. Or a bottle of vermouth, or a bottle of wine, whatever it is I've got, I can sell to go. If I'm doing delivery, I can also do that via delivery, as long as we do a some kind of firewall that checks that you're 21 years old. So that I would think would make like liquor stores pretty angry. But if I was saying I'm selling you a mezcal Negroni with vermouth in it, the liquor stores would be like, yeah, that's cool. Right.
Yeah.
So I assume that just like restaurants, I assume that liquor stores have, some lobbying power and some say in the matter.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, the Retailers Association definitely does. And I think you're right. It that could be one distinction that people make is more, cocktails, mixed drink format. Yeah. Restaurants, do that and bars do that, but liquor stores don't. But it's interesting. In some states, liquor stores can't, deliver or ship to you either, off premise, still can't send you stuff. So I think that definitely in places that's the case, there should be kind of probably across the board liberalization of it versus just, picking one licensee. Because again, you get into these things where one licensee is treated way different. There's inherent differences, as you said, between the two. But yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, I think even if restaurants were able to sell bottles of mezcal, it'd be interesting what that market would look like. I would assume that it would probably be for more rare ones that there are, or at least things that are harder to find, maybe at your neighborhood liquor store. I don't know if, an absolute bottle of absolute vodka, you're probably still going to be bought at a liquor store, I would imagine.
Sure, it's like a restaurant. Boutique, it's like boutique brands and things like that. I can completely understand that.
Yeah.
let's talk a bit about your book. If I pick up your book, which I intend to do, what am I going to learn? How am I going to feel?
Yeah, well, we tried to make it fun. I mean, I could have written some policy, you know, tome that no one would have read. And I didn't really think that was what was helpful. So we tried to make it fun, and it basically has a one kind of bizarre, quirky, weird law from each state in the country, and then a couple extras, and matches that with a cocktail recipe. Oftentimes the recipe is inspired by the law. So for example, in Washington State, the distilleries can serve up to 2 ounces when a visitor comes on site. They can't go beyond that, even though, you know, breweries can serve and wineries can serve as much as they want. So in that case, for example, I made a cocktail with 1.9999 repeating whiskey in it. And so I just try to have fun with it and just kind of poke fun at kind of the nonsensicalness of it. And talk about some of the history. And also, you know, profile some people that actually are living this and working in the industry and been really affected by these laws. It's hurt their business. And also I even throw in some fun profiles of famous American moonshiners. So I think it's a fun time. I just try to, you know, keep it lighthearted, but also raise some awareness about it, because I think that it's an important issue that has probably only gotten more important with COVID, but because people in the industry right now are struggling, and I want to help them. And I think this is not enough by itself to help them, but I think if some of these laws were liberalized, it would at least be part of the puzzle.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a favorite obscure one that's in the book that you want to share with us, or even one that's maybe not so obscure, but you have some reasoning behind it?
Yeah. Well, one, I mean, mini bottles are always really fun. So I reference Louisiana a lot because everyone kind of used them as anything goes state. Up until 2014, they didn't really allow airline bottles to be sold in the state. They finally green lighted it, and I believe it was 2014, but they're technically supposed to be twice as large as the normal one. So I think like 100 milliliters instead of 50 milliliters. And you know why, I don't know. Mini bottles have their own special history that no basically governments can't decide what to do with them, whether they love them or hate them. So that was a fun one that I got Chris Hanna down there to work with me on kind of trying to batch up a cocktail that could be at least, you know, put in different kind of mini bottles and then all smuggled on board with you on the plane and then enjoying it up there. So that's just a fun example. I love that one because he helped me out with it, and you know, again, it highlights that you don't know where these goofy laws are coming from. You know, places you would never associate with something bizarre like that have something like that. So.
Right. I mean, speaking of the mini bottles, I remember what year did it end in South Carolina where they only served mini bottles at bars? You would order a Jack and Coke and you'd get a mini bottle of Jack and a half glass of Coke, and you had to crack it and pour it yourself, I recall.
Yeah, that's the most famous example of all time in South Carolina. Yeah, in 2006, I think, is when they finally scrapped that. But yeah, it's funny. Wayne Curtis wrote a really funny article for Imbibe 3 or 4 years ago where he listed, like, you know, just what I said, that all the different states, and some of them thought that mini bottles were, you know, bad because it could lead to maybe more public drunkenness if people could sneak them like in their coat pocket and stuff versus like a big bottle. And then like other state governments and local governments were like, well, actually they're good because there's less alcohol in them, so you can't drink as much at one time. And it just led to this, you know, governments treating them in all different kinds of ways. Some loved them and some hated them. So it's a microcosm, I guess, of the greater stuff around and uncertainty around alcohol laws.
I mean, my assumption with mini bottles, and especially with that South Carolina example, is that I just assume follow the money. They're being able to tax every single drop, right? They're not missing a dime on doing that, right? And they're being able to control. But the flip side is, you know, thank God it ended in 2006, because if you went in there and you wanted a cocktail that had more than one spirit in there, you know, you're looking at, you know, $60. You know, if you get, you know, you're 21 years old and you want to go in and just get something like a B-52 for your friends, like, you got to have all these mini bottles on the bar. And also just the environmental impact seems ludicrous to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, not only that, but I mean, a lot of the companies that are making mini bottles, you know, it's not necessarily some, you know, small batch whiskey from, you know, upstate New York or something. It's obviously the big guys, right? So if you're trying to do a particular drink or have a particular mezcal or something in it, it's not, you know, 100% that they would be making just mini bottles for South Carolina. So, yeah, I think you're right that it's good that went by the wayside when it did, because I don't think it would be viable anymore.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite ones is Ohio, because there's, and maybe Jared, you can like speak more to this because I'm gonna mess this one up as I often do when it comes to numbers. But in Ohio, there's a certain cap on what's considered beer and wine as opposed to spirits, right? So it's, I think it's 20% alcohol it's usually up to 20% in most states, but then 20% is included in the beer and wine category. So for instance, Kahlua is 20% alcohol, so it would fall into the beer and wine category. So in Ohio, if you get Kahlua, it's 21.5% alcohol, because otherwise it would be sold in the beer and wine places, like for instance, like gas stations.
Wow. I learned something today. I had not heard that one.
So the differentiation is ABV, whereas here in New York, we do have something similar to that. If you have a beer and wine license, you can't sell, obviously, spirits, but you can sell some things that are higher in ABV, but they have to be fermented, not distilled, is the distinction here, right? I mean, here we go. Here we are already some somewhat experts on the air, and we're already confused.
There's a ton of states do stuff like this. I hadn't heard those two examples. I mean, there's legion examples of states that define all the different categories of alcohol differently. One fun one that I do know, West Virginia, originally after Prohibition, they only allowed quote unquote non-intoxicating beer, which was essentially the weak beer that we talked about. But then over time, their answer to that was just to keep redefining non-intoxicating beer. It's now up to like 12% ABV, which anyone that has 12% ABV beer is going to know is pretty dang intoxicating. But still under the state code, like if you look it up, it's still, you're only allowed to serve non-intoxicating beer in West Virginia. It just happens to mean basically all beer. So yeah, there's tons of examples of states that are trying to define different categories of alcohol, and that can affect, as you just said, where it's actually sold.
I mean, I'm not super proud of it, but when I lived in New Orleans, we used to literally say beer doesn't count.
Sounds like New Orleans, yeah.
I mean, you'd say I had five old fashions and 10 beers, but the beers don't count, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I love that.
Beer's what you drink while you're trying to figure out what cocktail you're going to have.
Exactly.
Just a placeholder, yeah, exactly.
So you and Greg together have worked on this new project, The Right to Drink. It's a new 5-episode narrative style podcast about drinking and everything that gets in the way of that. These laws that you've been working on policy for. Talk about the show, guys.
Yeah, I'm sure Greg's got some thoughts about it. It's been awesome to work with him. A little bit intimidating though, since he's works with you guys, and then also his wonderful podcast Backbar, I guess is the name you're going to be using for it now, Greg. Mm-hmm. But just kind of listening to that and then being like, oh man, like I'm expected to have something that's remotely as good as this, was a little intimidating, but it was fun. It's a little bit of a preview kind of for the book, and so we kind of pick a different category or a different issue, like whether it's shipping laws or happy hour rules or things that might raise the price of your cocktail, compliance cost rules, and do it kind of narrative style, but then splice in some clips from interviews of people. We try to kind of pair like one legal regulatory expert per episode with one person that actually is a distiller or a brewer or a bartender. Again, just trying to make it accessible and fun for people. We're not trying to make it so wonky that no one's going to understand it. We want to kind of raise awareness about what's going on out there. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun for me. It might be less fun for Greg since he has to
it's been a ton of fun, man. And I mean, like, this is when you and I were first sort of talking, when we were kind of, I feel like as a freelancer, like there's no better analogy for like, oh, do I want to work with this person on this project than like being on a first date where you're sort of like trying to put your best foot forward and being like, well, this is what I have to bring to the table, but also like, so could the, then what do you, and what is, where do you see this going, like what do you bring to the table? And I was fascinated because you had a very specific vision for what this show is going to be, which is cool and necessary, because in the last 6 months, like, people know that I do podcasts, and people, lots of people have come up to me and said, hey, I'm thinking about starting a podcast. And I say, awesome. What's your show about? And they're like, well, it's about drinks or Frisbee or politics. And I'm like, I always tell them, it's like, there are, I think I last checked it in February or January of this year. We were closing in on a million different podcasts on Apple. And I'm sure that during the pandemic, we have just blasted past that threshold because everybody wants to start a podcast because, you know, we are social creatures and we like to talk and learn things and experience each other's viewpoints. And if we can't do that in person, online is the next best thing. So podcasts, especially because the barrier to entry is so low, are a very natural fit. But to make a show good, it has to be about something that somebody else isn't talking about. And, you know, the cool thing about working on this show is that it's about, you know, there, I'm sure it's not the first show that's about alcohol legislation, but it's the only show that I've heard that's about, you know, this is what this law is. This is, it sounds weird, right? It is. This is why it's weird. This is what is causing that. And this is how we can make it better. And in the pilot, which is out now, we talked to a great distiller from, you talked to a great distiller from Virginia, Christine Riggleman. And, you know, I grew up in Virginia. I went to college in Virginia. I thought I knew Virginia alcohol laws pretty well, but you made the point that in that state, you can only sell alcohol at a state-run store. And if you're a distillery and you want to sell your products, that means you technically have to be a state-run store. And I didn't put that together. And there are all these tiny little rules that don't make any sense, and they exist because nobody really notices them except the people that have to deal with them on a daily basis to run their business and their lives, you know? And that's what's kind of, that's what's been cool about working on this project.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, it's trying to bring those stories to life. And, you know, I mean, in Virginia, I don't think people realize if the ABC store network doesn't want to carry your product as a distillery, then your products, you know, in the private retailing, you know, marketplace, you could then go to another store, theoretically, right, and try to pitch them on it. But in Virginia, you're locked out of the entire market for getting in liquor stores. And it can be almost a death knell, essentially, for some of the distilleries. And that's actually happens. Christine talked about, she's kind of an advisor to other distillers here, and they come to her, you know, just in tears sometimes, being like, you know, these three products, they, if it's a whiskey, it was maybe one they were aging for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and it didn't get accepted because they only can warehouse and stock so many spirits in these stores, and so that locks them out of the market. Where do they go from then? I mean, they can have on-premise sales, but that's not very big right now. Until recently, they didn't have the ability to ship in state. They do temporarily right now because of COVID. So, yeah, I want people to know that this is like a thing that's happening, and it's something that affects people's lives. You know, it for me, it's something that, you know, I can study and find of interest and research and write about. But for, you know, real people in the industry, it actually makes a difference on how much, you know, food potentially they could have on the table, literally in some cases. So especially right now, again, with how difficult things are. So that was kind of the impetus behind it.
Yeah, that example right there is powerful to me. You're saying that if I am a distillery making a product and I live in a control state and the control state decides not to pick up my product, then I'm not selling in my own backyard.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, just imagine that.
And that's how you start. Any business starts in your own backyard. You don't start up and sell in other states and other countries. You start up and sell locally. That's powerfully shocking to me.
You know, I have an example of this. When I was working for Brooklyn Gin, we would go to Portland Cocktail Week, right? And we were in Oregon, a control state, right, for a little while. But then, you know, it was while the brand was starting out. So, you know, it was hard to grab as much traction as needed. You know, what can happen in these control states as far as what you're talking about, as far as the actual state picking up the product and selling it in the ABC package stores and stuff like that, is that this can be a seasonal thing. Like, for instance, like something like gin, you know, a lot of people might drink it in the summer. Same with like agave spirits, right? So seasonally, it might be something that's in stock of these stores. But if it's if it comes off the shelf or out of the system in those states, enough people can request it to where finally the state will be like, all right, sure, well, we'll pick this up and then it'll be distributed again. But that could also be ineffective if it takes long enough through the whole season where you're wanting the product to get
yep.
put into the system. Then next thing you know, it's wintertime and everyone's on to whiskey or whatever, you know, like it's just kind of a crazy system. You know, it's yeah. very slow moving.
It is. Yeah. It goes the other way too, as you all know and referenced. I mean, for in Ohio, one of my people that I met and actually profile in the book, Richard Reed, he owns this really awesome gin bar, like outside Cleveland, right? I mean, of all places, a very like rural kind of or suburban area, he owns this awesome gin bar, and he has 96 different gins there. And I think to maybe people that aren't familiar with gin bars abroad, they might think that, oh, well, that sounds like a lot, but he's limited to those 96, and they're the ones that the state of Ohio's warehouse houses in their control setup for the distribution level. And he literally can request some after that, but that doesn't mean they're going to listen to him. And a lot of the stuff that he wants is like these really obscure things that the average consumer is not going to buy a ton of, right? I mean, it's going to be different than like going down and, pitching Bombay Sapphire that's already carried, but this is something that, you know, might be from Spain that, you know, not a lot of people have heard of, but he wants to be able to make a certain kind of drink in his gin bar with it. And he hates it. He's like, why can't I go to London and go to a gin bar that has 2,000 gins and come back here and I can't even have 200. So it really does limit the creativity and also just the access to market for both producers and also the retail bar restaurant level as well.
Yeah, that's the worst part to me is the access to market. Frankly, I feel like creativity comes from boundaries. So, you know, there's sure. a little bit there, but I understand that, you know, in other countries, it's kind of what we would consider sort of the Wild West. If they want something, they can just go buy it or bring it or hell, a lot of places, Italy, you can make your own stuff. Like, we can't do that here. Man, fascinating conversation, but here we are at the end. We'll probably have to have you on again and talk more. Pimp out your stuff a little bit. Talk about where we can get your book. Talk about your social media handles that we can get that we can follow along with what you're doing and the podcast itself.
Yeah, no, again, appreciate you all having me on. It's pretty easy. My book, Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink, is pretty much available through any independent major retailer that sells books. Easy to Google and find online. And same with the Right to Drink podcast, you know, Apple, Spotify, any place that you get your podcasts, it's at. I mean, appreciate you leaving reviews or whatever if anyone's out there listening. And you can find me on Twitter is, I guess, my main social media platform, because that's where policy people tend to all hang out and yell at each other. So it's at Jarrett Dieterle, my name, and Instagram's the same thing, but just Jarrett.Dieterle. So yeah, no, any of those places, I'm talking and thinking and sometimes yelling about crazy alcohol laws.
yelling into the internet void. Just so people get it down pat, it's Jarrett, J-A-R-R-E-T-T. Dieterle, Dieterle. That's both on Instagram and Twitter. The Instagram one has a dot in between, Jarrett Dieterle, right?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. Man, really, really fascinating talk. I'd love to keep going. But really, really great to have you on the air and talk to us about this stuff. And I'm going to probably tune into to at least one episode of your show on my commute to work today. So excited for
Beautiful.
That.
Yeah, if there's any problems with it, just email Greg. So,
my email is Jarrett.
Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Speakeasy. Hope you learned something. Hope you found something to use in your life. Cheers, everybody. Great to have you on.
Yep. Cheers.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.